It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll make some great marinades on this week's edition of Food Friday and dig into the science behind why they work and why they sometimes don't. First, if we want lessons in enjoying life, we can learn a lot from the French and their concept of joie de vivre, the French term that translates loosely to joy of living. That's according to our next guest, who has spent years living in France and wants to share what she's learned about the French approach to food, work, art, and even time, and how it can increase the joy we experience in day-to-day life. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever lived or worked or vacationed in France? What did you like or dislike, or what puzzled you about French culture? How do you bring joy, joie de vivre, into your life? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Kathy Yandell is a professor of French and Francophone studies at Carleton College in Minnesota. She's the author and editor of books about French culture, literature, and history. Her latest book is called The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World. She's giving a presentation at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee tonight at 6:30. Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
I apologize at the outset for my French pronunciation. Now, you say joie de vivre is a uniquely French concept. How do you try to translate that into American for us?
Well, I think you did a good job. I think joie de vivre, literally joy of living, is a pretty good start. But I find it interesting that even the English language dictionary and Webster's, you see joie de vivre as an English word because they can't quite translate all of the concepts that are bound up in that. So I find that really amusing, which is actually what got me onto the subject in the first place.
And you've been so close to France for so many years, but it wasn't always that way. Can you tell us about your first experience getting off, literally off a boat into France as an American? What struck you at first?
Well, since I come from New Mexico, first of all, taking a ship over, which was what students did. I was on one of the last crossings of the SS France. And when we then were taken to Paris and I got out, it was really like absolutely discovery of this big, big world, people rushing by, looking so elegant. And I felt like my broom-colored, blonde, boring self stepping into this new world. So it was quite a shock for my New Mexico culture, but I very quickly learned to love it.
For Americans, I think sometimes there's admiration, yes, for France, but sometimes there's, I think, mockery. And there's also intimidation. Like you were just saying, it's so sophisticated and we can't hold up. Can you make the case that it's worth looking beyond those stereotypes and learning from the French daily life?
Absolutely. And I also think that France has changed a lot. You used to hear people saying, the Parisians are so, they're not polite to you and they are so dismissive. And now I think that, 20, 30 years later, they're very much more patient. But I do think, yes, especially when you get into family life and life with friends, it's a very different culture from what you might see in the more just elegant images, which are still present in the street, of course.
Talking to Kathy Yandell, author of The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World, getting some daily life lessons from her time in France. You can join in if you have thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Kathy, I want to start digging into specifics here. And I'm going to start by confessing that earlier today I committed a crime under French law. I ate my lunch at my desk here at work. French law says no, right? You can't do that.
That's exactly right. The idea being that when you're at work, you work better when you separate, the relaxation time. So you're encouraged to get away. I mean, by law, you're supposed to get away from your desk. Sometimes companies have cafeterias, but very frequently people will just go to a nearby cafe and have lunch away from work. Now, they made some exceptions during COVID, and I need to see whether they've continued to suspend the law or not. But absolutely, it is still on the French books that you cannot eat lunch at your place of work. at your desk.
And that really speaks to a different attitude, right, toward work in France versus here in the United States. What kind of lessons do you hope we could take from that and other examples of how France approaches work and our lives outside of work?
Well, I think the lunch example is a very good one for the idea of mini vacations, right? So that even within the course of one single day, you have to take some time out. You have to take a breath, have to get away. Maybe the sort of physical pleasures of eating or even having a little coffee at the end, the little tiny French espresso coffees, and all the while being talking with people and just enjoying a moment that isn't just caught up in the daily schedule. And I think we Americans are not quite as good at that, as being able to separate these different aspects of our lives, and they all sort of blur together.
Let's stay with the food theme. Another thing, and again, I'm very un-French in this way. When I go out to a restaurant, I want my food, I eat my food, I leave the restaurant. There's a very different attitude, it's from your writing in France, when it comes to how food is eaten and how long one might take to do it.
Yes, that's true. I mean, especially at weddings, but we won't even go into that. I mean, those literally last all night. But just even for a daily dinner, for example, one of the examples I always think of is when you go to a restaurant in this country, sometimes the waiter will come around and just whisk away your plate, right? And even if other people at the table haven't finished, the idea is we want to clear this off. We want to get this finished. And the nice thing about France is they assume it's much more of a communitarian kind of thing. So it's not the individual finishing a plate that matters. It's that everyone at the table has finished the plate that matters. And so you're really reminded that it's a communal experience all the time. And I think maybe that's why you're supposed to get away from your desk as well, so that you can actually commune and communicate with others.
And actually, I do want
to
get into
that experience.
I do want to get into that wedding, because one of your early experiences in France, you're not prepared for what went into a French wedding and the food therein. Could you share that experience with us?
Right. Well, so it was at a country home, and it was really beautiful, and there was a terrace, and we were all outside, spread out, and there's champagne and little hors d'oeuvres, and I thought, oh, this is just so wonderful. So we're having lots of hors d'oeuvres and champagne. And then we sit down and we have a Lyonnais specialty, which is quenelle. And they're these little sort of dumplings with a Nantua sauce that was so wonderful. And I thought, oh, that's been a great meal. Now let's wait for the dessert. But no, that wasn't even the main course. And so the courses kept coming with the cheese. And by this time, I'm absolutely winding down and just beginning to sort of peck at the food. And then comes the big wedding pièce montée, which is kind of like a wedding cake made of different pastries. Anyway, I learned the lesson that you really need to pace yourself. But I also learned that part of the pleasure is just spending the evening discussing and exchanging and tasting the different dishes as they go by. So, yes, I learned quite a bit on that evening. And then dancing, of course, that comes later.
You also,
for those who can move.
Right. Now, you also spend some time looking at art in France, and you see contrasts in how French people and their attitudes toward art go, and Americans. Compare and contrast for us how we look at art.
Well, obviously there are different aspects of this, and I would say that the French have art really around them all the time. So, you know, even in the metro, there'll be certain stations that will have different artistic works just displayed. And so I think also with the age of the buildings that are all around them, I'm talking about Paris right now, it's like art on every corner in some ways. And I think at least among my French friends, the idea of going to museums and taking in, I mean, even cinema is seen, even films are seen as, you know, not only what you do with Netflix, but definitely the experience of going to the cinema and then discussing it at great length afterwards. So again, it becomes a kind of a community experience. So I find that art is a little more integrated into daily life. One summer recently, I was there and they were doing outdoor readings in parks, and they were just free and they were sponsored by a local theater. And that sort of thing just pops up kind of everywhere.
We're talking to Kathy Yandell about her new book, The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World. Kathy's speaking at Boswell Books in Milwaukee tonight at 6:30. You can join the conversation here at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about what she experienced in France, what she hopes to bring home to American culture? Have you been to France for work, with family, for a vacation? Was there something there that struck you as different, maybe changed the way you live your life here in the United States? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Kathy Yandell about her new book. It's called The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World. Kathy's speaking in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, at Boswell Books today at 6:30. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Based on what you've heard, do you do things similar to what our guest is talking about in France? Do you like long, long meals at restaurants where the staff don't pick up your plates the moment you finish that last crumb of food? Do you find little ways to take time away from work, say, to find something to enjoy, that little thing? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. You talk in the book, Kathy, about French attitudes toward activity and exercise. Now, our producer, Colleen Leahy, studied abroad in a small town in Brittany when she was in high school, and she would go on jogs a few times a week, swim laps at a local pool, and you know, people thought she was super athletic there in France. She said, Colleen est très sportif. Colleen never saw other people jogging and got weird looks, she says. I don't know, do French people make less of a distinction between this is exercise and this is not exercise?
That's such a good question, Rob, and it's changed a lot in recent years. I mean, right now there's a humongous push because of the Olympics, and I can't quite figure out why it is that all of a sudden France wants its own population to be more sporty. But lots of, I talk about this in the book, lots of new sort of parks with exercise equipment and so on have opened up throughout Paris and throughout France. But I also want to say that there are loads of people, men, women, older, younger, running in parks now. And literally 5-10 years ago, that wasn't the case. So I think, I don't know whether it's, whether you could argue that it would be the Americanization of French culture, or maybe just the fact that having such sedentary jobs as many of us do, there's much more a push towards sports now, or if not sports, at least health culture, where you're running or going to the gym or something like that. So I think Colleen's experience was really typical. I don't know how long it was ago, but in recent years, that's really changing. Some of my students, female students, even joined some female soccer teams on the outskirts of Paris. And they said there was one distinction, and that is that they found that they were a little more aggressive on the field than the French women. But the French women, you know, in the World Cup, I haven't followed the latest games, but they're a very strong team now, too. So I think the times they are a-changing.
And Kathy, you point toward throughout the book, there are tensions in France about migration and immigration, as there are here in the United States. You point to that, though, in many ways as a strength of France and to so many of the things we talk about, whether it's food or art or culture or athletics, the powerful role of immigrants in French culture. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. After the Second World War, and then again after the War of Algerian Independence, a lot of people from Northern Africa who were, you know, in colonialized French countries, like particularly Morocco, but Algeria and Tunisia as well, many of them, and some from sub-Saharan Africa as well, have immigrated to France. And I really believe that it's made it a much richer country. I have a friend who recently said, without a hint of irony, that couscous is a fully French dish. Well, yes, it's become a French dish, but it's actually a North African dish, but it's just worked its way in French culture. And I think the same can be said about hai, which is a type of singing from North Africa. And one of the things I mentioned in the book is that I think it's 4 out of the past 6 years an African origin baker has won the baguette contest sponsored by the Elysee, which is like the White House in the US. And it's a blind tasting, and all these very specialized bakers from all over France taste these breads. And the one that wins will get to supply the White House, the Elysee, for a year. And 4 out of 6 times it's been an African origin person. So I find that really interesting and heartwarming that the culture is getting so much richer by these immigrants. I'm not saying that there aren't tensions. I'm not saying that it isn't difficult, and also that there aren't certain people who do not like the idea of having so many immigrants. But I am saying that from my perspective, it has been a good thing.
On a related note, here in the United States, we have ongoing debates about how we tackle historical injustices, slavery and segregation, for example. You find at least some positive examples of how France talks about its history. What do you see there?
Well, there's a commission that Macron put into effect a few years ago to look into the Algerian War, for example, because part of the problem of that is a lot of censorship on both sides, not to know what was happening on the other side, but particularly in France, having covered up the torture that took place during the Algerian War of Independence. And they think that the way to healing is, of course, not to sort of pull the wool over anyone's eyes on that and to expose what really did happen. So that commission, the first iteration of that commission, I think, did not accomplish very much, but there's yet another one working on it so that the two sides can finally come together and talk about what really happened, with the idea, I think a little bit like what happened in Rwanda, of getting beyond those conflicts. So I guess, like many countries, France is working on that. It is something that's in the forefront of their conversations, as well as some restitution of art objects, for example, that were more or less stolen from these different regimes during the colonial period, and some of which are now being returned to the countries in question.
Talking to Kathy Yandell, author of The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World. Now, Kathy, I gave a couple of examples in which I'm very un-French. I eat lunch at my desk sometimes. I blow through the restaurant meal really fast and then get out. One thing that did resonate with me, you point toward embracing the small pleasures in life. And that is something I definitely try to do, whether it's just, you know, a cup of coffee or something like that, really savoring those little things to find that joy. Could you talk about that a little?
Yes. It's just little moments of joy. And there've been several books kind of thinking about this in France recently, but it's something that I saw in France long ago, of just taking the time to take a moment to appreciate this particular view. And that's what I was talking about, art as well, or this particular taste, or this particular feeling of the weather. So very much that pleasure can be found not only in these more grandiose artistic things, or the absolute beauty of a mountain view or something, but can be found in these little, often sensual moments having to do with the senses.
Kathy, on a practical note, you spend obviously much of your time here in the United States, but how do you take some of these joie de vivre lessons you learned in France and put them into practice here in the United States, where sometimes our attitudes might be stumbling blocks to try to live that way?
Right. And I think everyone who comes back from France or from some country that they admire in some ways might adapt those particular rituals or ideas. But I know in family life, particularly, we always made a point of having dinner and as much as we possibly could, not rushing through it, because that was a time of day to sort of have our daughters say what had happened during the week and so on. And that's not always possible because kids in this country have soccer practice and they have a band or orchestra or they have theater, a million things. But we try to keep that a little bit sacrosanct. And I know other kids in the neighborhood would, grab their meals and run back outside, but we tried to have that as our one time that we could check in. And that sort of came from my French family, really trying to honor dinner time. That's one little example. Another example is just trying to incorporate ways of looking into our lives, ways of looking at art, ways of appreciating what you're seeing and talking about what you're seeing. Because I think in this country with our children, that's another thing that I learned about sort of joie de vivre, and it sounds counterintuitive, but it's that French kids are actually taught to argue and they're taught to question what's told them, even if it's by their parents in some ways. So you're having, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And that sounds like that you're learning to fight back or something. But what it ends up being is that they then know that their opinions are valued, but they have to defend them. And so I think that leads to a kind of a sense of self that's a little bit different from the one that we give our children when we say, oh, you think that? Oh, that's nice, rather than challenging them, which I think leads them to have more autonomy, which is why I think French 18-year-olds, for example, seem a lot older than American 18-year-olds.
Kathy, we'll leave it there. Have a great visit to Wisconsin, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Kathy Yandell, professor of French and Francophone Studies at Carleton College, author of the book The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World. If you're in Milwaukee, you can see her tonight at Boswell Books at 6:30. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll answer the question to marinate or not to marinate. You could share your answers, how you marinate, maybe before you hit the grill, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, find out about the potential legal risks facing 10 Wisconsin Republicans who claim to be electors for Donald Trump after the 2020 election. Now, the decision of whether or not to marinate meat before cooking has confused me and other home cooks and grillers over the years. Then there are sub-questions like what should be in a marinade? How long should things marinate? Good news, our next guest has some solid answers. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll dig into the science of what marinating can and can't accomplish and get some recipes to put it into practice. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a marinade recipe you keep handy in the kitchen? What's your favorite type or cut of meat to marinate? What have you always wondered about? Why marinating works or doesn't work in some cases? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Gritzer is Senior Culinary Director at the food and drink website Serious Eats. He was previously a food editor at Food & Wine magazine and a restaurants and bars staff writer for Time Out New York. He also worked as a cook for several years at a variety of restaurants in New York City. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
You've worked around and written about food for a long time. Has your position on marinated meats changed over that time?
with sufficient marination, it has on the topic. It's definitely evolved, and there's a lot of things that we just published an article recently on Serious Eats about the science and technique of marination. I worked on it with a wonderful writer, cook, and person with a really extensive food science background named Tim Chin, and his work confirmed a lot of things that we had kind of understood for a while, but we really did some very specific tests just to make sure that the advice we were giving really held up.
One misconception that I certainly had about marinating was, okay, I'm going to put this marinade on and it's going to have, salt, but it had pepper and all these other flavors, and all those flavors, the longer it goes, are going to sink down to the middle of the meat and I'll taste it with every bite. Not so much.
As it turns out, not so much. Without a doubt, marinades do add flavor. There's no question about that. But marinades, in terms of flavor, really are mostly a surface treatment. There's no just absolute hard rule. There might be some flavors that manage to get a little bit farther in than others, but almost none of the flavor really penetrates beyond the surface of the meat.
Except there's one magical substance that does go deep down if we leave it long enough, if I have it right, and that is salt.
Certainly salt. Salt's not the only one, but it's probably the most important one. Yeah, salt in a marinade, which most marinades have salt, really does do things that with time it does more and more and better eventually can become a problem. But yeah, so salt, because it dissolves into sodium and chloride ions, and on the molecular level, those are really, 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 really small. So they can get into the meat, and they do, and they help meat. I mean, essentially, it's a brine, right? A marinade, in a lot of ways, in terms of its effect over time, it acts as a brine. And so salt helps meat retain its moisture, retain juices, and it also seasons the meat. You do taste the salt deeper into the meat. So that's definitely a positive.
And salt, as I understand it, Daniel, is doing more than just adding flavor inside the meat. There's some texture things going on. What do we know about the science there?
Yeah, so salt can dissolve some muscle proteins. This can help when you cook the meat, because if you think of a piece of meat kind of like a sponge, it's saturated with water. And when you cook meat, the muscle in the meat contracts from the heat. And that contraction is kind of like it's almost as if the heat were a hand squeezing the sponge. And so the hotter it gets, the tighter it squeezes together. And you can see it, right? If you think about how, when you cook a piece of meat, you see it get smaller. You can actually see this with your eye. It contracts. And with that contraction, it squeezes out the moisture, which can make the meat seem more dry. So what salt can do is it gets in there and it dissolves some of those muscle proteins. And so even though the meat will still contract when you cook it, it won't contract quite as much, quite as quickly. And that helps the meat stay juicier over time, which is like kind of precisely what a brine does, whether it's a wet brine, meaning you're submerging the meat in something that's liquid that has salt in it, or if you do a dry brine, maybe dry brine chicken or turkey, where you just sprinkle salt on the outside of the meat and just give it enough time, at least an hour, and for bigger pieces of meat or a turkey or something, several hours, give it time for that salt to dissolve and then penetrate into the meat.
Talking to Daniel Gritzer from Serious Eats on this edition of Food Friday. We are talking about marinades and marinating, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest? Are you cooking meat, maybe grilling meat tonight or this weekend? You need some advice? Do you have a favorite go-to, a magical secret that you're willing to share with us? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's talk about timing, Daniel. In that piece, you mentioned that science test, you tested different meats, different marinades, different lengths of time. What kind of answers did you find out about how long is long enough but not too long?
Yeah, so these tests we did specifically with chicken, pork, and beef. And as you said, we explored a lot of different common variables in marinades, salt, sugar, flavorings, like whether it's herbs, spices, garlic, you name it. And what we found was that the primary thing a marinade does, if it's left for any time, is what we were just talking about. It acts as a brine, which is not nothing. That's not, you know, that's I certainly wouldn't say a marinade does nothing, or that there's no benefit for leaving meat in a marinade for some time. And then, of course, like we were just talking, flavor-wise, not much is changing over time in terms of the penetration of those flavors into the meat. One other thing that can happen with a marinade over the course of time is if the marinade has some kind of an acidic ingredient in it, whether it's vinegar or wine or citrus juices, the acid can also do things, it can tenderize the meat over time, which can be a pleasant effect. But if the acid is left for too long, it starts to shift out of just sort of a pleasant tenderization and transitions into an unpleasant mushiness that you can start to detect as the meat breaks down more and more in the presence of the acid. There are also other ingredients similar to acid. They like fresh pineapple juice, fresh papaya. There's certain fruits that have naturally occurring enzymes in them that also break down proteins. And so similar to acid, enzymes can also have this tenderization effect that if left for too long, more than, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours or something, can start to go in the wrong direction.
We heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page from Steve, who writes, "I am marinating venison steak 4 days in a soy sauce base. It certainly gets tender." And he mentions he also dry rubs and marinades many chicken recipes, makes most of his own. Venison for 4 days, Steve, that seems like it might be pushing it a little long based on what you were saying, but maybe, I don't know, venison meat, I know, behaves differently than some of our more commonly cooked store-bought meats.
Right. I mean, it's such an important point that there are so many variables at play across different kinds of meat, different cuts of meat, different ingredients in a marinade, different marinade recipes, that it's very hard to make any kind of universal statement about what's a good idea, what's a bad idea. So, but to be really clear, I'm speaking in generalities here. Generally speaking, I would say, yeah, 4 days sounds like a really long time to leave anything in a marinade where you would see a, I don't know, a benefit. But then again, I haven't done tests on venison, so maybe there's something I don't know about venison.
Steve, report back about the impact of that 4 day soy sauce marinade on the venison. Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Madison. Mark, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
I have a question. We have a little bit of a debate going with my wife and doing marinades, and I want to fork my chicken before I do the marinade. I feel like it seeps into the chicken better and gives it better flavor. It does take more time, but I think it's worth it. And I was curious about the thoughts in regards to that.
And your wife, I gather, Mark, says no, don't poke it with the fork
She
first.
says, "Forget about it. I don't have enough time, and we got a lot of other things to do."
We got any money riding on this, Mark?
We do a little bit. Yes, we do.
All right, Daniel, we're solving a bet here. Where do we, and I think actually I know the answer because one of your recipes uses that fork.
Yeah, I think I'm so glad Mark asked this question. And I have good news, Mark. You and your wife are both right
Ah.
because she's probably right that you don't have time for this. So I'm not going to argue with that. At the same time, you, I think, are right that creating any kind of pathway for a marinade to get past the exterior of the meat is going to help the marinade penetrate into the meat more deeply. And I really what this is about is if we're talking about how deeply does a marinade penetrate a piece of meat, well, the big question is, how big is this piece of meat that we're talking about, or pieces of meat? What's the surface area? If I take a pork shoulder, and it's a whole boneless pork shoulder and it's huge, I mean, the marinade's really not going to get in there at all, like in any meaningful way. If I take that same pork shoulder and I slice it thinly and I marinate all of those thin slices, sure, in terms of actual millimeters of penetration into any given piece, it may be the same as that huge one, but I've created a heck of a lot more surface area for that marinade to be exposed to, which definitely makes a difference. So the idea of physically manipulating the meat, whether it's puncturing it, cutting slits in it, scoring it, slicing it thinly, cutting it into small pieces, all of these are very good tactics for improving how much of the marinade gets, all over the meat.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. It is a marinade edition of Food Friday with Daniel Gritzer, Senior Culinary Director for Serious Eats. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about marinating for our guest? Do you have a household debate? What works for you? What doesn't when it comes to marinating? Do you have any go-to tried and true recipes? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Daniel Gritzer, Senior Culinary Director for Serious Eats. It's Food Friday. We're talking all about marinating. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guests about how to marinate? Maybe whatever you're cooking this weekend. Do you have a success story or something that went horribly, horribly wrong? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mark wrote on Facebook, I make a pretty decent marinade for chicken breast. If you like tarragon, olive oil, kosher salt, and Grey Poupon like mustard. That sounds like a pretty good combo, Daniel. What do you think about that? Are there things you might add or subtract there?
I love the sound of that. I have a personal affinity for tarragon, and I think it marries especially well with chicken. So I'm already sold right there. That sounds like a great marinade. Mustard is very flavorful. The salt is going to be doing the kind of brining thing I was talking about. I think the oil is an interesting element because that's another thing that we looked at with this article on the science of marinades. And fat is a very important ingredient in cooking because for many reasons, but one of them is it can be a great conduit of flavor. There are many flavor molecules that are not soluble in water, but they are soluble in fat. And so fat can do a great job of getting flavor out of flavorful ingredients and spreading it around. At the same time, fat does not penetrate a piece of meat. So in terms of the marinade and that question of penetration, the presence or absence of fat isn't going to make much difference, but that still doesn't mean it's not a good thing to put in a marinade. You get the tarragon flavor, the mustard, the fat is going to really help spread it and coat it on the meat evenly. And then also fat's great because once you throw the meat on the grill, it's going to help with the grilling.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jude is on the line in Tomahawk. Jude, hi.
Hi. I have a marinade recipe that I've used for 50 years that I got from a family that I was a governess for when I was working down in Highland Park, Illinois. And it's two ingredients, and it has always been everyone's favorite marinade. It's wishbone Italian dressing and soy sauce.
Just Italian dressing, wishbone brand, you said? Italian dressing and soy sauce.
I always use wishbone, and I always use LaCroix soy sauce. And it's a simple, perfect marinade. I put wishbone in a bowl, and then I add enough soy sauce to just color it brown.
And what are we doing in there? Chicken or whatever you want?
I do steak cut up for shish kebabs. I do chicken for shish kebabs. I do vegetables, peppers, mushrooms, onions, cherry tomatoes for shish kebabs. And it's fabulous.
Jude, thanks a lot for the call. And I got to say, Daniel, sometimes I know when I'm in a hurry in particular, I'll just plan on using a salad dressing on a marinade. Do you have any favorites for a shortcut like that?
I don't have anything like a personal thing that I do that's that I could offer beyond what you're just saying. And it's a smart move. I mean, on the one hand, this marinade is only two ingredients. On the other hand, Italian dressing has many ingredients, right? So you're saving yourself a lot of time because you're getting all the flavorings from that dressing. You're getting all of the herbs. There's going to be some acidity in the dressing. Plus, you're going to have fat, other seasonings, whatever Wishbone is putting in their specific their formula, and then you're spiking it with the salt and umami of soy sauce. So you're getting a lot of bang for your buck there, and in general, that kind of thing is a very clever thing to do to keep your cooking life easy. I have two small kids; I don't always have time to do everything from scratch, and still get a lot of payoff.
And Jude mentioned a magic word there too, Daniel, kebab. This is a great, you mentioned expanding your surface area, having more surface for the marinade and that flavor to come in contact with. For a grill, a kebab is a great way to do that, right?
Absolutely, yeah, because you're cubing the meat, so you're getting, just like you said, you're increasing the surface area on that meat, which is going to give you more opportunity for the flavorful marinade to cling to more places.
We are talking on Food Friday to Daniel Gritzer from Serious Eats, talking about marinades and marinating. We've got a couple recipes linked to WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got the ingredients there, a link to Serious Eats there. Daniel, I want to check at least one of those out. We've got a yogurt and mint marinated chicken thighs with pickled nectarines from you all at Serious Eats. A lot going on there, and it sounds awesome. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this recipe is from a food writer and also an amazing photographer named Nick Sharma. Nick came up with this recipe as he was doing a separate investigation for us specifically about the effect of acid in a marinade. And he was sort of starting the question from an anecdotal observation, which is that he felt that marinades that are like yogurt based marinades, which is that's lactic acid, right, that we're talking about in that particular case, he had observed that those marinades seem to be more gentle on the meat in terms of the negative effects of acid over time, and he wanted to look into it further. Nick also has a science background, so he was very well suited to this task, and indeed with his own side-by-side testing, he did find that lactic acid marinades are more gentle on meat than marinades that have, say, citric acid from citrus or acetic acid from vinegar. That's not to say that citric acid or acetic acid are bad in a marinade, but just you have less room for error in terms of when they start to make the meat become mushy. And so he created this particular marinade just as a, to illustrate the point. And Nick has a wonderful palate. And it is a yogurt marinade that has mint, and he serves it with these peaches. And it's just a great summertime recipe.
We got a call from John, who couldn't stay on the line. John wanted to ask if MSG can be a good substitute for salt and the pluses and minuses of MSG in a marinade. And Daniel, if I read right, I think MSG is something that does in some ways penetrate like salt does.
Yeah, this was really interesting. MSG was one of the things that Tim tested for this article. And in fact, MSG did get into the meat. And if left too long, it started to alter the texture of the meat in what Tim felt was an unappealing way. I think he described it as sort of getting a kind of squeaky texture. But MSG is a, I know there can be concern around MSG and headaches and stuff like that. There's been a fair amount of debunking around it, even if it's not a totally settled question. I use MSG or other ingredients that are very high in umami, which is basically what MSG is, all the time, and love it. And, MSG, it's not the same thing as salt. And so I don't know that it totally replaces salt. I mean, obviously, if you have a low salt diet, you're going to look for strategies to, compensate where you can. But it's extremely complementary. I mean, MSG, like other umami ingredients, it enhances this sort of inherent deliciousness of anything. It's very hard to put your finger on that flavor. It's very easy to say, oh, this is salty, this is sweet, this is sour. But umami we all know it and we love the foods that have it, but it's a bit harder to describe. But it's a great ingredient, whether in a marinade or anything else, frankly.
Daniel, let's end with a bit of food safety for first timers. Marinating meat, we probably don't want to use that marinade later, right?
Right, unless you cook it. Right. So the concern with using any kind of a marinade as a sauce after you've marinated the meat in it is that the marinade would still have potential, I mean, it would definitely have bacteria from the meat in it. And so you'd be reintroducing the bacteria onto the meat after you've cooked the meat, which is, generally not the best idea. So you have a couple options. One is you can put some marinade aside if you would like to use it as a sauce in some form, and do not put the meat in that reserved marinade. That marinade, in theory, is safe to use later. And the other option is you can cook the marinade in some form. You could brush the marinade or baste it onto the meat as it's cooking in order to sort of build up layers of it. And because it's getting exposed to heat, that's fine. Or if you wanted to simmer it in a saucepan or something like that and sort of transform it into some kind of a sauce, that also is totally fine. So the big issue is just uncooked marinade that has had raw meat in it is absolutely what you want to keep away from your cooked food.
Thanks to our guest on Food Friday, Daniel Gritzer, Senior Culinary Director for Serious Eats. Find a couple marinade recipe suggestions at WPR.org/Food Friday. A few weeks back, I talked about celebrity sightings, those moments where we run into famous people out in public. The other day, I had that happen with a twist where I was the celebrity, sort of, except I wasn't. I was coming out of a store, I had sunglasses on, which might be part of it, and a guy on the way into the store says to me, "Hey, you look like Ozzy Osbourne, like a young Ozzy Osbourne." Now, all I could say was, "Thanks," and I moved on. Here's the thing, though, and I checked in with my wife, she confirmed this, I don't look anything like heavy metal singer Ozzy Osbourne at any age. Like, he has long hair, I have long hair. That's the end of the list of similarities. Our hair is even a different color. Okay, we both have kind of high foreheads, but that's really it. It's not a big deal. I'm just like bemused. Don't worry, I'm not going off the rails. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.